From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. The Supreme Court is just a few weeks from wrapping up its term, so we asked University of Baltimore law professor Michael Meyerson for some perspective. Where does the new justice, Neil Gorsuch, fit in philosophically? What messages is the court sending about gerrymandering or purging voter rolls? And what about the Justice Department's request that the High Court lift an injunction against the executive order that would block travelers from six Middle Eastern countries, especially since President Trump tweeted that ban is, quote, watered down, close quote. Meyerson notes the president has broad authority over immigration, but
what the president cannot do is favor one religion or harm another religion. And the very language of that first travel ban singled out Muslims as unable to get the benefit that non-Muslims could have in immigration.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. The Supreme Court is scheduled to wrap up its term at the end of this month. Good time for us to take a look at some of the court's rulings, as well as some pending cases before the justices. And joining me to discuss these issues is Michael Meyerson, the DLA Piper Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, where he teaches courses on American legal history and constitutional law. His most recent book is Endowed by Our Creator, The Birth of Religious Freedom in America, published by Yale University Press. Professor Meyerson is also director of the Fannie Angelos Program for Academic Excellence. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me.
Justice Neil Gorsuch was confirmed by the Senate in early April. How would you describe his judicial philosophy and how that fits into the court?
Okay, we don't know yet what his Supreme Court judicial philosophy will be. We know on the Court of Appeals he was a relatively conservative judge. But one of the things I always tell people is once you're on the Supreme Court, you can change. And just to give you a small example, over the weekend, he's at a conference with one of the more liberal justices, Justice Breyer. And my guess is that people like Justice Gorsuch didn't spend a lot of time with articulate, strongly minded liberals, and now he's stuck in a hole with them for the rest of his life. So I think that lifetime tenure and exposure to other opinions might make him more flexible. No one ever thought Chief Justice Roberts would support Obamacare, and he did. So while I think he's expected to be more conservative, and I think he's independent-minded, I don't think we know yet what his Supreme Court philosophy will be.
More conservative. Of course, he was appointed to replace Antonin Scalia, and some people have described this as a one-for-one trade.
That's the expectation. But I think, again, the power, when the framers created the Constitution and the court, and they created lifetime tenure, that means this person is now beholden to no one. So he may become more conservative. He may link up with Justice Thomas and become the most conservative, or he may not. But he's now free to do what he will. I think the expectation is, based on his life and his writings, is that he will tend to be on the conservative side.
And just to be clear about the mechanics on the court, Justice Gorsuch can only participate in the cases since he joined the court that he heard argued, correct?
That is correct. He cannot vote on a case he did not hear oral arguments about.
Do we have any sense of what proportion of, I think they heard altogether 71 cases in this term. Any idea how many of those he'll have a hand in?
Well, there were some that they had they held for re-argument and some that that have not yet been scheduled. So I don't think there'll be too many blockbusters that he is not involved with, for the simple reason that if it's a conservative-liberal split, it would be a 4-4 split, and the court hates a tie.
Speaking of blockbusters, the Trump administration has been fighting legal battles since March to reinstate the ban blocking travel from six predominantly Muslim countries. Last week, the Justice Department asked the Supreme Court to lift an injunction imposed by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and hear the dispute. The New York Times quoted from the Justice Department's brief, quote, "The stakes are indisputably high. The Court of Appeals concluded that the president acted in bad faith with religious animus when, after consulting with three members of his cabinet, he placed a brief pause on entry from six countries that present heightened risks of terrorism, close quote. So the Trump administration is appealing the ruling from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals.
That is correct.
The Ninth Circuit Appeals Court is still deliberating on another court challenge to the travel ban. Can the Supreme Court take up this issue without a ruling from this lower court first?
The answer is yes, the Supreme Court can do what it wants, especially in a case involving allegations of national security. I think, though, that this case, as befitting this president, is the strangest case I have ever seen. Just yesterday morning at 6 a.m., President Trump tweeted what would probably be the worst single legal argument he could have made. He called the new version of the travel ban a watered-down, politically correct version of the old one. That's his phrase. And if you remember, the very first travel ban was struck down, and I would say easily, because it showed clear religious animus. While the president legally has tremendous discretion over immigration, what the president cannot do is favor one religion or harm another religion. And the very language of that first travel ban singled out Muslims as unable to get the benefit that non-Muslims could have in immigration. They rewrote the new ban in a neutral way and were arguing it had nothing to do with the old ban. President Trump just gave up the game and admitted it was the same goal of keeping out Muslims.
But isn't this a big part of the argument, is whether or not the court will look at just the words of the policy of the executive order, or whether they will take the president's tweets and other comments into consideration?
Absolutely. But before the most recent tweets, the main argument was this sounds like his campaign, and political campaigns are always different from governing, and it's a long time ago. To say contemporaneously that this is still essentially an anti-Muslim ban, I think is a very different and much harder for the courts to ignore.
There's also the question of timing. The quote from the Justice Department's brief that I read refers to a brief pause. That is how both executive orders were described when they were issued, that they would be temporary. Arguably, the time has already passed that they could have revised whatever vetting they wanted to do.
Another incredibly peculiar thing about this case is that they were screaming from the Justice Department this was national security and emergency, and yet once they lost in the lower court, nothing happened. They were allowing day after day and week after week the ban to be stopped. And so it's very hard to feel national emergency when they're not acting like it's an emergency.
But the question I was trying to get to was, given even if they decide to take the case, it would not be argued till next fall. Is it likely that the ban would be over by then, or the executive order would be over by then?
Certainly the literal terms of the original order, the ban would be over by then. But I suspect that if the court allowed the ban to exist, they would just restart the clock. Remember, this is all language from the president, so he could certainly restart a 90-day clock. But again, it seems to make no sense, since they should have been spending this time doing a neutral, effective way of vetting those who want to come to our country.
It's University of Baltimore Law Professor Michael Meyerson here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the Justice Department asking the Supreme Court to take up President Trump's travel ban, halted by lower courts. Let's turn to gerrymandering. The courts heard a case about gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is manipulating political boundaries for a party to gain advantage. The court ruled that the North Carolina legislature unconstitutionally redrew two districts based on race. Tell us about this case.
Well, there are a couple of ways of doing gerrymandering, which generally means drawing a district that has no purpose other than political advantage. And of course, in Maryland, they're fighting this as well, because it's a very common, though I think incredibly disliked, thing for politicians to do. Now, obviously, you cannot discriminate against African Americans in drawing districts. That's old news and important news. However, the Voting Rights Act says that districting also must allow minorities to have a reasonable chance of victory. So what has been done in the past is that minorities have been packed into one or two districts so that they would have be the majority and have a better chance of winning. But of course, that meant more of the other districts had no African Americans, which meant not only that only whites were winning, but that the whites who won could be completely insensitive to African American needs, since there were no voters they had to deal with. So what the Supreme Court said that I think, if I can have a rare moment of optimism, is that in order to protect minority votes in North Carolina, you do not need to have 50% or more minorities in a district, since many whites, not a majority in North Carolina, but 20, 30, 40% are willing to vote across racial lines. So basically, the argument of we need a majority African American district is no longer necessary to ensure minorities have a reasonable shot of electoral victory.
In the North Carolina case, how did the court determine that race was the motivating drive?
That was one of the easier questions, since basically in most of the cases, the legislature admitted that they were using race in order to create a majority black district. They admitted they were using race, but were claiming they had a good reason to do so, which was allegedly protecting the ability of African Americans to win elections in small districts.
Is drawing boundaries for partisan advantage constitutional?
Sadly, yes. Sadly, at this point, the Supreme Court has said largely that legislators are largely free to use line drawing to help candidates with very, very few exceptions.
Voting rights. The Supreme Court declined to review a lower court decision that struck down North Carolina's voter ID law, means the state's restrictions on voting will remain void. The court is expected to take up another case on voting rights, Ohio's policy of purging citizens from its voter registration lists who don't vote regularly, who don't regularly cast ballots. Tell us about this case.
Okay, one of the sadder things that goes on around this country is the attempt in many states to reduce the number of people eligible to vote and make it harder for people to vote. That's what the voter ID is so often seen as, a means to limit who can vote. So in Ohio, what was done was the reasonable goal, allegedly, was to make sure that people who had moved were not registered in their old locale. So the way they did that, however, was look to see who hadn't voted recently, send one letter, and if those people didn't answer, they wiped them from the voting rolls. And the argument was that this was simply too aggressive a means of taking voters off of voting rolls and was not justified by federal law.
And so that's the question before the court.
That is the challenge for the court. The Court of Appeals struck down Ohio's law, and the Supreme Court agreed to hear that appeal.
In 2013, the Supreme Court struck down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The section designated which parts of the country must have changes to their voting laws cleared by the federal government or in federal court. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice John Roberts said, quote, "Our country has changed. While any racial discrimination in voting is too much, Congress must ensure that the legislation it passes to remedy that problem speaks to current conditions," close quote. How does that relate to the North Carolina and Ohio cases?
In a way, it relates to both cases because it shows that the Supreme Court was simply incorrect, that race is still a fundamental cause of voting decisions, and the voting decisions are awfully made to restrict voting, especially African-American votes. However, both of the two cases, North Carolina and Ohio, dealt with other voting laws or other aspects of the voting law. So the North Carolina case voted with a part of the voting rights law that actually authorizes discrimination, or at least race-conscious, race awareness in line drawing. The Ohio case is a different law involving national voting rights. So actually, what you end up with is multiple statutes being interpreted by the Supreme Court.
Are these really significant decisions about voting rights? I mean, are these going to be foundational?
They won't be foundational. They will matter certainly to the people who raised the case, and they'll matter around the edges. But I think what we saw is that the Supreme Court was avoiding taking blockbuster cases over the last several months because they simply did not know when they would get nine justices. They were waiting for Justice Gorsuch. And so maybe the year after this, we'll see more blockbuster cases.
On that point, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about privacy law, patent law, and cakes for a same-sex wedding. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm joined by University of Baltimore law professor Michael Meyerson for a Supreme Court update. Earlier, we talked about President Trump's travel ban and some gerrymandering and voting rights cases before the court. I want to turn to a case about patent law. Last week, the court seemed to hand a victory to consumer groups, Impression Products, Inc., the Lexmark International. Tell us about this case.
Okay, this is a case that really deals with the right of someone who has a patent to control what happens to that product after it's sold. Remember, patent law is interesting because it means those who invent or hold a patent get a monopoly, and they can control who uses it and how it's used. The question is, once they sell it to a consumer, do I, the consumer, have the right to do with it what I want? So in the Lexmark case, what happened was you have basically cartridges for printers. And consumers were selling those cartridges to another company, Impression, that would then refill with their own ink and sell much, much cheaper than the Lexmark cartridges. And what the Supreme Court held, and I do agree, this one is important, is that once a product is sold, the patent ends. It's now your product. You can do with it what you want. So if you want, you know, now you can have a contract and all, but Impression was free. They had no contract with Lexmark. They were free to use this item as they wanted.
So you can basically reverse engineer some item that you buy, figure out how it works, make a small change, and pursue it.
Not exactly. You can use that product you buy that you engineer, but you can't make more copies of it. Oh. That would be the patent infringement. But that, the individual cartridge you buy, you can then sell to a competitor of Lexmark.
The Washington Post headlined its story about this Supreme Court decision, quote, how a Supreme Court ruling in printer cartridges changes what it means to buy almost anything, close quote. Is it that significant?
I think that's a bit hyped, but I do think, since much of what we buy is not patented, among many other reasons, but I do think it means that in a world of monopoly and less competition than we'd like, this is a way to foster competition and allow those who don't own patents to compete with those who do.
The High Court also seemed to narrow privacy rights last week. At any rate, in County of Los Angeles v. Mendez, the court made it more difficult to sue police, rejecting something called the provocation rule. Tell us about this case.
Okay, this involves basically the meeting of several different doctrines. It's always been the case that people can sue the police for using excessive force and sue under the Fourth Amendment, the Constitution. On the other hand, we also know that some force it can be reasonable when the police reasonably fear for their safety or the safety of others. The question was, if the police acted with, quote, reasonable concern, but did so in a search that was their fault because it was unreasonable, they didn't have a warrant, they burst in, was there a different standard if they, quote, unquote, provoked the action? And the Supreme Court unanimously, and this is unanimous, said no. Basically, there's only two flavors. Either it's unreasonable excessive force, in which case someone can sue, or not. So I don't think this changes much. The Supreme Court never actually said there was more than one standard. So if in terms of privacy, it simply means the question of excessive force is no longer relevant to the privacy question. You can sue for one, but you cannot sue for excessive force unless there is, quote unquote, excessive force.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with University of Baltimore law professor Michael Meyerson. We're catching up on the Supreme Court, some of its recent decisions, some of what it has ahead of it. There's a church and state case. The court has heard but not issued a ruling on a case involving Trinity Lutheran Church in Columbia, Missouri. What's at stake there?
Okay, so this is a case where the state is funding something as pedestrian as rubber sheets to cover playgrounds. And because of a clause in the state constitution, they will give it to non-religious schools and public schools, but not to religious schools. So they are, in a sense, discriminating against religious schools because the constitution of their state says no money can be used in aid of the church. So the Supreme Court is deciding whether that distinction, keeping money away from only religious institutions, violates the Constitution, equal protection, and freedom of religion. And what's interesting about that case is that most of the liberal justices also seem to agree with the conservatives that that was discrimination violation of the Constitution. Justice Breyer asked during oral arguments, Could the state refuse to send police to a religious institution? Seeming to show that it's one thing to favor religion, but to treat religion worse seemed to trouble most of the justices.
But some liberal advocates in the case are arguing against the church, though, because they're worried about state resources going into the hands of an institution which they think may discriminate against, say, gays.
Oh, there's no question that when you allow religious institutions discretion, that means they will be able to discriminate, which leads to a lot of other very, very important issues. The question is, though, whether a broad funding policy can single out religion for exclusion. And there are arguments for both sides, certainly, but those who watched the argument were betting that the liberals would join with the conservatives again and strike down the limitation.
There are a couple of cases that have been relisted several times. What does being relisted mean?
It sort of is where the court seduces and abandons you. They announce they may make a decision on when they'll hear a case and then pull it back and then relist it. And the general guess was these were decisions that they felt were so certain to be dividing the court 4-4. They kept waiting for Justice number 9 to show up. And so they have not yet been rescheduled. One involves gun control. One involves a gay couple who wants to marry and a baker who does not want to serve them a wedding cake. And both of those are seen as highly divisive. And I think everyone expects Justice Gorsuch to be the ninth vote when those cases are finally heard.
When they're finally heard.
Heard, yes.
So we're not going to get the answer in those cases until next term.
The court is free to always add time. They may do it at the very, very end, or they may wait till next term.
I know we're waiting for some key cases, none of them perhaps blockbusters, but it's probably premature to ask you. Do you have any idea how we're going to remember this term of the Supreme Court?
I think we're going to remember it mostly as a wasted year, the result of the Senate refusing to hear the nomination of Judge Garland, and just basically a wasted year where time was lost because the Supreme Court could not get to 9.
I really appreciate you walking us through it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Michael Myerson is the D.L.A. Piper Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, where he teaches courses on American legal history and constitutional law and directs the Fannie Angelos Program for Academic Excellence. His most recent book is Endowed by Our Creator, The Birth of Religious Freedom in America. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for being with us on The Record. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.